You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The coronavirus ended up stranding a lot of us at home, working, learning, taking care of kids. And that technology dependence could have backfired into an addiction for some people. According to AddictionCenter.com, although the majority of people's use of social media is non-problematic, there is a percentage of users that become addicted to social networking sites and engage in excessive or compulsive use. Dr. Anna Lemke explores these constant cravings for online connections and why they happen in her new book called Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Lemke, who runs Stanford University's Dual Diagnosis Addiction Clinic, says we're all seeking a quick fix to find validation and attention and love. I spoke with Lemke about this dilemma with the tech most of us need to use every day.
More and more of us have developed these minor addictions, not because we're innately vulnerable to addiction, but because we live in an addictogenic world where we're constantly being primed with these highly reinforcing behaviors and digital products. And they're designed to be addictive. I mean, they're exactly designed to hook us, to keep us watching the next episode. You know, they end on a cliffhanger. Even children's books now, you know, this chapter finishes and it's like, you can't not start the next chapter, and they're designed that way. And so our brains are like slowly being rewired essentially to sort of be hooked on something.
Is it just this craving for dopamine?
Well, what happens is that when we engage in highly rewarding behaviors or ingest, you know, highly rewarding substances, that it releases a lot of dopamine in our brain's reward pathway. And it sets us up for a vicious cycle, because the brain adapts to that elevated dopamine by downregulating the dopamine that we're making and our own dopamine transmission. So we essentially go into a dopamine deficit state, which then drives the craving to want to use again. So it's really easy to get into this vicious loop anytime we expose ourselves to a highly rewarding substance, of which there's a lot out there, right? Where it's not hard to get the next fix. Like, it used to be harder. Like, if you were addicted to alcohol, you know, and you had to like make it yourself, that automatically inserts like a rate limiting factor. That's not true anymore. You know, I talk about in the book, my own romance novel addiction, and it really took off when I got a Kindle. Before, I had to go to the library, I had to actually browse the shelves, you know, I had to take it home. Now, all of a sudden with my Kindle, it was just like one click away and I was off and running, and I lost control.
Yeah. And it makes it less special too, because you don't have to make an effort.
Well, exactly. I mean, another way to say that is that we become tolerant to the same stimulus, and then we need more potent forms. And that's what happened to me. You know, Twilight was my gateway drug, and I went from Twilight to, you know, 50 Shades of Grey. You know, it's like, well, what happened? How did I get here? You know, but that's exactly what happened, because then the like Vanilla Toast doesn't work anymore.
My thing was the whole Meghan Markle Megxit thing, right, and the people on YouTube. And I was watching one, then I saw the other, and I'm watching the other, and I go from one to the next till, and now I've kind of off of it, you know, probably in my mind, in my subconscious, seeking something else, but it's probably just because nothing has happened.
Right. So you keep looking for the next Meghan Markle installment. I know. And it's so easy to kind of get trapped in that. And one of the things I recommend in my book is that if there's something like that, that once you start watching it or doing it, you can't stop, that's probably a good thing for you to avoid. For me, it's like Dr. Pimple Popper YouTube videos. I cannot tell you why my brain loves those, but literally once I watch one of those, I have to watch 20 more. Like, I cannot just watch one. And so it's really important to just recognize that what's happening in the brain is we're getting a huge hit of dopamine. Our brain is trying to re-regulate and reassert homeostasis, you know, normal level physiology, by downregulating dopamine. But then that abrupt downregulation of dopamine drives us to want to use it again. So those really potent rewards are essentially, you know, dangerous.
Well, I think too, our work lends itself to it, because it's so easy. You take it home and you're writing. It's like, I'm going to post this, I'm going to post that. And you get such good feedback from doing it that you want to keep getting it, even though it really, that one little thing does not necessarily, you know, get you anything beyond that moment of happiness.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're really tapping into, you know, the way that social media, and I define social media as really any way that we're connecting online with other people, has become, you know, a drug in and of itself. And the truth is, we are biologically wired over millions of years to want to make connections with other people. Making connections helps us find mates. It helps us, you know, use resources, and it helps us protect us from enemies. So we're wired to connect. And oxytocin, which is the love hormone, is released when people praise us, when they like us, when they agree with us, when we experience the same emotion at the same time that they're experiencing it, that same emotion, that releases oxytocin. And what we know through the work of my colleague, Rob Malenka here at Stanford, is that oxytocin actually binds to and causes the release of dopamine in the brain's reward pathway. So those things are exactly linked. So when we have this experience that somebody liked what we did, or, you know, gave us a thumbs up or gave us a good rating, it absolutely releases dopamine. It makes us feel good. But the more it happens, the less long it lasts. And then we need something even bigger and better than that. And we get into this terrible, vicious cycle, which is why it's so important to take a break from that and get perspective.
So you would advise people to try and take a break from the cell phone, from the computer, from our devices?
Yes, I really think that initial dopamine fast is essential to reset reward pathways. It's really hard to go from a lot to less than it is to go from a lot to none, and then go from none back to using in moderation. And almost universally, my patients who do a dopamine fast for typically 4 weeks is what we ask for. You know, they come back feeling better, but also they almost always want to go back to using their drug of choice, but they want to use it less. They want to use it in moderation. So then we talk about self-binding strategies and what are the barriers they can put in place. And those take many forms. They can be actual literal barriers where they don't keep the drug in the house. They can be chronological barriers where they like set certain days of the week or certain times of the day or certain amounts of time when they're doing their drug or not. One of the things that I personally use is Wi-Fi intermittent fasting. So we all have heard about intermittent fasting with food, right? Where you eat during an 8-hour window, but you don't eat outside that 8-hour window. I do that with being online. I try really hard to be efficient and productive in about an 8-hour window online. But, you know, after I get home, I commit to putting it away and not being online again in any form until, you know, 9 a.m. or whatever it is the next day. And let me tell you, it's really hard for me. It's a struggle, but it's really worth it because I find I'm more present for my husband, for my children. I do other things that need to get done. And with that kind of moderation, we're less likely to get into that vicious cycle where our engagement makes us depressed.
That was Dr. Anna Lemke, a psychiatrist and the author of the new book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Lemke has been working with people with addiction issues for 25 years, and she runs Stanford University's Dual Diagnosis Addiction Clinic. You are listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. We just heard about getting stuck in the rut of addiction, but many of us, women, can be stuck on the sidelines, afraid to speak out and be recognized. Author and certified life coach Andrea Owen says staying silent can have serious consequences for women, including lower pay, a lack of opportunity, and a general lack of enjoyment in life. Her new book, Make Some Noise, Speak Your Own Mind and Your Own Strength, shows how women can break away from lifelong conditioning that keeps us from reaching our potential and making a difference in the world.
We can't talk about women's empowerment without talking about the culture that raised us. No matter if you're a Gen Z or a millennial or a Gen Xer like myself or a baby boomer, it covers all generations. And yes, I do think that we're making progress for sure, but we still have a long way to go. And, you know, we are conditioned and socialized to be quiet and polite and accommodating for sure, to put everyone's comfort before our own at the expense of our own lives.
Right. And I think also we see other women who put themselves out there and they're called a lot of bad names.
Sure.
And really, you know, sometimes seen as they're quote unquote troublemakers.
Difficult. As someone who I am direct, I'm outspoken, and that's just part of my personality, that I have been called all, I can't tell you how many times, Mary, I've been called intimidating and have toned myself down for it and apologized for it and felt ashamed in some moments that I am too much for people. And I think it's a stereotype that we need to break down as a culture and as a society. And it starts a lot of times with the women themselves. And that's what I'm hoping to get from this book is not so much prescriptive. It's more, I want women to get curious about the culture that raised them and ask yourself questions like, what is my conditioning and what is my truth? Especially when you find yourself hesitating to ask for a raise or ask someone out or ask for help around the house.
Yeah. And I think that, and doing that, and then when you know you should have done it, then you feel bad. Then you feel even worse because you realize that you've not taken advantage of something.
Yeah. And I think that what you just said, the feeling bad is sort of part of the process. I don't encourage people to feel guilty or have regrets, but I don't think it's avoidable many times. And so I invite people to learn that, to take that as a learning lesson and sort of information that was an opportunity. And next time, do something different. Take advantage of that opportunity.
You point out in the book at the beginning, talking about asking a question of, I believe it's a math, you're in some kind of math class, and asking the teacher, I guess it's in college, about doing this formula, doing this operation. You know, nobody else really understands it, but everyone else, they're afraid to say something because they're kind of afraid of the teacher thinking, oh, you don't know what I'm doing, and I look silly. But it turns out that he said, okay, let's go over it again. And everyone in the class probably was like, oh, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm. Even when I think about it, I still feel like the visceral discomfort of it. And it was my undergrad, but it was still a higher level stats class. I have a degree in exercise physiology, and I was so confused, and I'm asking my peers, you know, do you understand this? Nobody understood it. And I raised my hand when we all went back to the lecture hall and asked if you could go over it again. And the professor said, no, we've been over it. And I said out loud, hey, I've asked everyone if they understood it, and I can't find a single student in here that understands it. And you know, that discomfort, like when you say something out loud and there's that pause and then you have all this regret about speaking up. I felt that. And then he said, and I had had him at this particular professor in other classes, and he said, you're a tough lady, Andrea. And I remember thinking, would he have said that if I was a man? And it made me feel like slightly uncomfortable / ashamed in the moment. But I also noticed that in my peripheral vision, nobody was looking at me, and a lot of people were looking down. And so all of that to say, it made me realize how deeply uncomfortable we are with confronting truth, and many times when it's uncomfortable. And I thought, well, I guess I'm just going to have to be the one who volunteers as tribute often to speak up for things like this.
Yeah. So how can we nudge ourselves into doing it or feel more empowered to do that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that there's a myth that we have to feel empowered first before we take the action. And I wish that it were that easy, but unfortunately, it's not. The research shows us that self-confidence comes from taking action and having these experiences. And honestly, it doesn't always work out. You know, my professor could have said no, and you know, how dare you ask? We've gone over it. Test is tomorrow morning. Good luck. It doesn't always work out. The safety net doesn't always appear, but we have to take this action. And then on the other end, even if it doesn't work out, we didn't die. You know, we didn't, you know, fall and have it a complete disaster. I hope that doesn't happen, but we need these, even if they're small action steps. So that's how we get to that place of empowerment.
That was author and certified life coach Andrea Owen talking about her new book, Make Some Noise, Speak Your Own Mind and Your Own Strength, where she talks about how women can break away from lifelong conditioning that keeps us from reaching our potential.